Judge panel split 2-1, declaring Proposition 8 unconstitutional in February. Supporters of the measure hoped that a full panel of the appellate court would revisit the case and possibly change the ruling. But a majority of the judges on the Ninth Circuit voted not to rehear the case. Brian Brown, president of the National Organization for Marriage, a group that supports Prop 8, blasted the ruling.
It's wrong, and we expect that the Supreme Court is going to correct this gross miscarriage of justice.
Opponents of Prop 8 applauded the ruling, saying it promotes fairness and equality for same-sex couples. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News, San Francisco.
Checking Wall Street, the Dow is up 167 points. The Nasdaq is up 49. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Charles Schwab, offering market commentary and perspective on changing markets online, by phone, or in a local branch. Learn more at schwab.com.
More than a million families in America live in public housing, but cities nationwide are demolishing such homes in the name of community improvement.
I truly believe that additional housing needs to be in place before we can start knocking down buildings.
If I lose this, I have nowhere else.
Danville, Illinois, and the debate over public housing, a three-part series from CU Citizen Access and Illinois Public Media, next week on the Afternoon Magazine, right here on WILL AM 580.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of foods from around the world, including cheeses, olives, spices, hot sauces, olive oils, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, in this first hour, we will be talking about jazz and playing some music and talking specifically about someone who is clearly an icon of jazz history, Thelonious Monk. One thing we can certainly say is that he is an important figure in jazz. He has certainly inspired many musicians across now several generations. One thing that's interesting to note about him is that if you look back into the early years of his career, according to our guest for this hour, Gabriel Solis, Monk was considered something of a controversial figure. And in fact, there was a time when the jazz press almost completely ignored him, and it looked as if never be as well and as widely known as some of his contemporaries, men like Dizzy Gillespie or Charlie Parker. This morning we'll talk with Gabriel Solis about his recent book. It's titled Monk's Music, Thelonious Monk and Jazz History in the Making, published by the University of California Press. And it's an effort to take a look at Monk and what he means to jazz and perhaps what he's meant to some specific musicians, talk a little bit about his music, what about it is special and unique, and we'll play some for you. If you're not familiar with Thelonious Monk, we'll give you a little taste of the music. Our guest, Gabriel Solis, is assistant professor of music here at the University of Illinois and is particularly interested in jazz and African-American music. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a great pleasure.
Here, early in the book, I think you tell a story about being in New York and going to talk with a pianist who is particularly known as an interpreter of Monk. And you say, well, you're trying to explain to the guy what you're intending to do that eventually ends up being this book. And he says to you, well, why Monk? And that's probably a good place to start. Why concentrate on him as opposed to any of the number of other musicians, composers, performers that you could have done?
Absolutely. It was a great conversation because I had wanted to write about Monk for years, frankly, and I was a great fan of him and his music. I knew that it was important music. I knew that it was music that had touched a lot of musicians, but I hadn't taken the moment, I think, to ask, why Monk? Why not Duke Ellington, who clearly had an enormous influence? Or why not John Coltrane, who in some ways had even more of an influence, I think, on players, or at least on saxophone players? And I was able to say to him, well, I think that Monk is a crowning figure in some ways. He is the person who more people have drawn on in jazz than perhaps anyone else. And that he's a person who, in the course of the the last 20 years or so has been claimed as an ancestor figure or as a model or as a person in the lineage by literally every kind of jazz musician, so that people playing the most kind of accessible, most inside mainstream jazz look at Monk and say, that's the man, that guy. He did this thing, and we want to draw on him. And the people playing the most far out, you know, most avant-garde stuff look at him and say, that's the man. That's the guy who was doing the thing that we want to do. And sort of everybody in between. So that to me, it's the reason that the book is in some sense not just a study of Monk, though it is that, but also a study of how lineage works in jazz and how jazz musicians cultivate relationships between themselves and great figures from the past, and also not so great figures. I mean, all sorts of kinds of influential relationships actually occur in the music.
You didn't set out to do a biography. If people want to read biographies, there are full-length biographies of Thelonious Monk. So that's really not what this book is about. But having said that, what really do you think it's important, at least to start out, for people to know about him, about his life?
Yeah, I didn't write a biography. And as you say, there are lots of full-length biographies. And on the other hand, I do actually start the book with a chapter that gives a little biography. Yeah. And I think it's really important to know certain things. And I think part of why it's important to know those things is that they're important to the musicians who think about him. I think it's important to know that he was absolutely his own man from the very beginning to the very end. He did not bow to social pressures to conform, sort of ever. And that includes, I think, one of the things I love about him, there are a lot of great stories about him. One of the ones that I find most sort of, human and beautiful is that he also didn't not only bow to, let's say, society's general pressures to be normal in any particular set of ways. He also didn't really bow to the jazz scene's pressures. So people will tell stories about, like, Monk didn't actually spend a lot of time hanging out on the scene. He went to clubs. He did listen to fellow musicians. He played a lot. But also, he was a family man. He loved his wife deeply. He loved his children. He spent a lot of time with them. He was more likely on an off night to be at home than he was to be out. He was more likely to be hanging out with his family than he was to be hanging out with, the cats on the scene, so to speak. And so there's a real sense of him saying, this is just, I'm who I am and I'm going to do my thing. So I think that's a really important thing to know about his life in terms of thinking about what his music sounds like, because it also does not sound like, I think, anyone else. It is absolutely distinctive, which is one of the core things that jazz musicians, I think, are trying to do, is to find that individual voice, that particular sound.
And that would be one reason why, no matter what kind of musician you were, no matter what your style was, no matter what you were trying to do, you could point to him, and that would probably be one of the things you would say, that's why I think of him as a mentor or a model or whatever, because no matter what, he was his own person, and he really didn't care what other people were playing or what other people were saying or whether he was considered to be in the mainstream or not.
Yeah, absolutely. And Joe Lovano, I quote, I think, in the book, said this to me. We were at I was at one of his shows, the Village Vanguard in New York, and I was chatting with him backstage afterwards. And I said, when did you start listening to Monk? When did you first sort of realize that's somebody you really dug? And he says, oh, I was like in high school. And I was listening to all these tenor sax players, and I realized, well, it's easy to tell a tenor sax player because there's so much you can do in terms of making the horn sound different, so that it's like a voice. That you can tell people's voices immediately, right? He says, but piano, it's much harder because you have less control of sound on that instrument. He says, Monk hit it for him because he realized he could always tell it was Monk playing piano, not just by the notes he chose, but by the sound he got out of the instrument. And I thought, Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we should not go too much further before we play some music. We thought we might start out here. This is Thelonious Monk. The tune is I Mean You, and this is a recording from 1947, so this goes back some ways. Anything before we play it, anything you want to say about it?
Sure, absolutely. This is a great recording. It's really from his very first significant session as a leader, recorded on the Blue Note label for a collection of tracks that were released as a series of LPs titled The Genius of Modern Music. It's like 10 years after he starts really working. So he's a long time before he actually gets a solo recording contract. And these are all of the recordings, these early Blue Note recordings, which I recommend to people unreservedly, are wild and woolly. They are really out there. You get the sense of people just barreling along, doing their thing. It's a very short recording. It's only three times through the song form. What impresses me perhaps most about it is the way that you hear him and the vibraphone player Milt Jackson taking a shared sort of solo together in the middle of it. Milt Jackson goes first and Monk goes second, and the two of them are so different. And they play so nicely together. I know that Jackson was one of Monk's favorite musicians to play with, and I think it's because he's a very bluesy musician, and it's a perfect kind of foil to what Monk does.
Okay, well, let's hear it. I Mean You, 1947. Thelonious Monk is the pianist, Milt Jackson on vibes. And our guest this morning is Gabriel Solis. He's professor, assistant professor of music. Is that right? Assistant?
That's right.
Assistant professor of music here at the University of Illinois. And he's particularly interested in jazz. And we're talking this morning about Thelonious Monk. And if you're interested in reading some more about Monk, you can look for the book that Gabriel has written, Monk's Music, Thelonious Monk and Jazz History in the Making. It's published by University of California Press. In listening to that music, and I think, well, how would I describe to somebody else what the music was like? Maybe I would talk about his playfulness. Mm-hmm. I would talk about how he always does unexpected things with tempo in terms of changing the pace of the music here and there. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I really think about is I think that some music seems to flow down a very predictable track in the sense that you could sometimes you could play people a phrase of music or play part of a phrase and say to them, okay, what comes next?
Right.
And they might actually be able to tell you what comes next. You can't do that. You just can't do that. Yeah, maybe you could guess what comes next, but it could be very likely that you would be completely what he'll play something and then what comes next is just a surprise.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, that's it, right, in a nutshell, he is unpredictable. I'm sure I listen to this stuff too much so that I've gotten into his little head and I have some idea, right? And I think that's actually something that a lot of the musicians that I talked with in the project, you know, writing this project, that they talked about was that they felt that to do it, to play his music, they had to live with it, right? They had to live with his recordings for a long time. I mean, they had to really seriously get into what is it that he's doing? Because there is a logic to it, but it's not the same logic that you and I work with, right, on a regular basis, or that most musicians work with on a regular basis. So that they had to get a sense of what was he going to do. I think one of the things you hear in that recording, I hear in that recording at least, is that so if you listen to the bass player and the drummer, John Simmons and Shadow Wilson, who in particular was one of Monk's favorite drummers to play with, and a real sort of swing kind of drummer, not like Monk. And this actually carries through a lot of his recordings, that he hires these bass and drum players that will hold everything together so that he can do these things that are totally unpredictable. He can do things with time that make you go, wait. Or he can fiddle with the rhythm, right? So he can move a lick, a little melody. He can move it around in time because the drummer and the bass player are steady on the whole time. Chakadoom, 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 just keeping time together. It's what makes this stuff not fall apart.
The other thing I think maybe about this, but about him generally, is how different his music was. And I think about, you know, the other kinds of music that people might have been listening to in 1947, popular music or jazz. This must have seemed, at least to a lot of people, this must have seemed so strange. Hearing it, I can't imagine what it would be like really hearing it for the very first time and what sort of reaction you would have to it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. I think that musicians at the time, really, really cutting-edge musicians, picked up on what he was doing. And he was certainly very important in helping people like Dizzy Gillespie or Charlie Parker get to the language that mainstream modern jazz was in the 40s. But I think everybody else, I think most other people listened to this and just went, whoa, what is that? And I think it's possible to capture a sense of that a little bit, even though, you know, the goalposts have shifted since then. Yeah. Just in as much as I can still put these recordings on for other people, I can almost still put them on for myself and go, I can't believe that he just did that. I can't believe that anybody recorded these things. They're so unique. They are so unlike everything else.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that's really interesting to think about, and I know you look at, is how it is that maybe over time we change the way that we listen, or what we will accept changes, or what sounds strange. And I think that now, listening to this music, you might say that it was, you know, quirky.
Yeah.
If you were familiar with Thelonious Monk, as you said earlier, if we put on some piece, maybe it was some Monk piece, you'd say, well, yes, I've heard of Thelonious Monk. And you could put on something that I or other people would say, well, I've never heard that particular piece. But you could say, okay, well, I know who that is.
Yeah,
you might come up with all kinds of different ways to describe the music, and yet we wouldn't. It doesn't seem all that strange. I can, you know, I've heard avant-garde jazz that I would say really sounds strange. Like I couldn't listen to it. I would say, yeah. Look, I'm sorry, I'm not there. I can't listen to this. But I have no I have no problem listening to this. And I can even go, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Okay, that's, I can hum it for you. That's not so strange. I think it's interesting that somehow over time, what we think is odd and what we think is just okay does change. And I don't understand how exactly that happens.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And I think, I mean, there's lots of different things. So one of the things is that... as we hear things, this stuff then can take on additional resonances. So for me, for instance, these early recordings, these Blue Note recordings, more than his later recordings, I also hear them. They sound punk rock to me in a way. They sound a little bit like these are people just going full on to do something a little outrageous. Well, I wouldn't think that in 1947. Right. So there's that. But also, I think it's the process of people learning from this is part of what's really made it easier to hear. And obviously the process of people moving the goalposts further along, people doing more and more outrageous things. So certainly things that in 1960 would have just been too much, you know, now are actually part of the mainstream language of jazz. And I think that's part of what this music does, is that the music is a music that's been both progressive and absorptive, maybe. That is, musicians have, there's always been a kind of cutting edge of musicians who are willing to push the envelope and say, maybe you could do this. And also been a music where people, where the rest of the community has over time said, well, you couldn't do all of those things, but some of the things that guy was doing, yeah, we want to do those things too. And so that there's been a kind of a gradual sort of moving of what is jazz even over the years.
Yeah. We have a couple callers here. Why don't we bring them into the conversation? We have somebody in Indiana on our toll-free line. We'll start right there. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I'm glad I tuned in this morning and brought back some memories. I was a lucky fellow. My younger uncle listened to WBAA out of Lafayette, Purdue University, and they had jazz. And I was introduced to jazz when I was like 3 and 4 years old. But I do remember a couple things in the late 40s when I was getting more involved with buying records and stuff. There were two pieces that just, in a sense, what they call now blew my mind. One was Monk's Mysterioso, and the other one was Charlie Parker's Out of Nowhere. I still, when I hear Out of Nowhere, it still sends chills at me. It's like, where did that note come from? You know, it's just incredible. I think we're living in that age where we're finding out now, for the important jazz people were, of course, just like a few days ago, they had a fellow on talking about the Doors. And I made the comment that I still have a lot of my Doors albums right up there with Miles Davis albums, too. So we're getting to pick and choose now and see who had all that influence. And I had some young friends down at when I was in Chapel Hill. We were musicians, and they just, you know, listened to him and just, you know, acted incredulously how anybody could do anything like that. And I guess that's how Charlie Christian probably shook up people too back then when he started doing similar things he did on the guitar. It's an excellent program again. I'm glad I'm back listening. You're up to snuff again. Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. Any, you comment on that any way that you?
I just would say I really love this, what the caller says about, you know, I still listen to those. I can still hear that, and it sends chills up my spine, or it reminds me, it takes me back. I think this is one of the things that is in this book, and it's, I actually start with a quote from Ralph Ellison, who talks about, you know, one of the most important things that music does. And he's not just talking about jazz, although it is from an article on jazz. It's one of the things that music does is it places us in time. It creates a history for us. And so I'm, you know, yes, I have the same experience, and I will tell you that the musicians I interviewed for this project have the same experience. They talk to me regularly about, you know, being up on the stand even and playing. So Bobby Porcelli, for instance, who's an alto sax player who I just adore, talks about being up on the stand and playing the song Ask Me Now, which is the Monk song. And he says, you know, every time I play that song, I cry, and it makes me think about when I was first learning this music and when I was just going down to the village. This is in the 50s, going down to the village every night to hear this music. So, yeah, I mean, I think the caller's experience is a pretty common one.
Right. Let's talk somebody else here, Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. I'd like to hear some of the anecdotes, actually. I don't know. It's kind of hard to get one that's give several that are characteristic, but you know, it seems to me that Munch would have been called Augsburger's diagnosis, but I wonder how much of that is he was in control of, and how much of it was reaction to the milieu he was in, and the kind of I don't know. It's hard to say. Everyone's a critic. I'd like to know about the critics that kind of espoused him and the ones that were attacking him. If you can kind of characterize how that actually came about, but it seems to me that just like a lot of people still hate Miles for turning his back on the audience or being gruff, and it's just, you know, from their point of view, from a performer's point of view, with all the demands and all of the characterizations, you know, it seems that all you can do is maybe, you know, make your statement and let things fall where they may. So basically, I don't know. I assume that you did all these interviews, you got all these stories, and could we hear a few? And I'll listen. Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. I'm delighted to. I have to say, actually, of the interviews that I did, a surprising number of the musicians who I was working with, who are people currently working on the scene nowadays, actually never met Munch, and even many of them never heard him play live. It's a particularity of his own career that Munch stopped playing long before he passed, almost a decade before he passed, in the early 70s. So people who are younger musicians would never have had a chance to hear him. And he was also very reclusive. Even as a younger man, he was fairly reclusive. So and he hated to leave New York. He hated to tour. So a lot of what I was working with was not that sort of stuff. But indeed, I did hear a number of really brilliant and beautiful stories from musicians about working with Munch and playing with Munch and living with Munch and hanging out with Munch and just knowing him. He seems to have been a great guy. And so the caller's point that he sounds like maybe he would have been diagnosed, Augsburger's or some other thing. I always wonder how much of this is for real and how much of it isn't, because the stories I heard about people hanging out with him, he doesn't seem crazy to me. He doesn't even seem particularly oddball. I mean, he seems pretty much like a regular guy. So Steve Lacy, who is a great sax player and one of the most highly regarded players of Munch's music. He's the one person in all of these interviews I did that no one ever said anything but good things about his playing. And he's fairly avant-garde. He talks about that he knew Munch in the early 60s, and Munch, he played with Munch briefly. Then got to spend a lot of time just hanging out with him. And he says, Munch said, well, yeah, I like strawberry ice cream. Anytime you want to come by my house with some strawberry ice cream, come by. So Lacy would pick up a quart of strawberry ice cream and come by the house and hang out with him. He says, "Yeah, Munch had a lot of things to say. He would tell jokes, and they were not joke jokes. He would sort of make these observations that you had to think about and that would make you smile more than that would make you laugh out loud. Like he says, Munch would tell me, it's always night, or we wouldn't need light. And then I'd have to sit and think about that for a while, and it would shift my whole paradigm, my whole way of thinking about things. Or he says, Munch's favorite, I asked Munch, how do you learn this music? And he said to me, well, you got to dig it. To dig it, you dig it. All right, nice.
It's like a little Zen koan.
Yeah, exactly, exactly that, exactly that. My favorite Munch moment, though, also about whether Munch was really like nutty or self-aware and playing a role or what, this must have shifted over time. He does seem to have become, in some kind of sense, mentally unbalanced late in life. But earlier in his life, in the 50s and 60s, there's a really nice piece of video that's in the movie Straight No Chaser, which is a documentary about Munch. There's a really brilliant piece of video in it where he's in, I believe it's the Village Vanguard backstage, twirling around. He's spinning and spinning, and he looks at the camera and he says, "Now see, other people do that. They think they're crazy. I do that." And people go, "Look at him. It's Munch."
That's really nice.
Very, very nice. We're a little bit past the midpoint here. I have another caller we'll get to in a second, but just very quickly I want to introduce again the guest for anybody who's tuned in. Gabriel Solis is assistant professor of music here at University of Illinois. He's interested in jazz and African-American music and musicians and is the author of a recently published book, Monk's Music, Thelonious Monk and Jazz History in the Making, published by University of California Press. We have another caller here, someone in line two in Champaign. We'll talk with them. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. What about in terms of anyone truly mastering his technique? Was that accomplished, or has that been accomplished or not? Because I think it'd be very difficult.
Yeah, that's a fine question. I think that his technique is really peculiar, right? So he is not a virtuoso player when he records, though lots of musicians said, Mary Lou Williams is maybe the most famous one who said, Monk would come over to my house and he'd play and he'd sound just like Art Tatum. He chose to play the way he played, right? So it's oddball technique, but it's not super, it doesn't take like great pianistic skills. What it takes is a real will to play a particular way, I think. And though there are, I think, a lot of musicians who have over time figured out, oh, yeah, well, this is how he made that little sound. Here's what I do with my hands to get that little sound. One of the things that became very clear in interviewing musicians for this project was that what they wanted more than anything was not to ever have it appear that they were trying to sound like him or that they were trying to play with his technique, that because having your own voice is such a value in jazz, there's a real fear, actually, of being called an imitator, so that you had people who privately might be able to go, Michael Weiss is a piano player that I interviewed, is one of these people, for instance. Privately, he would show me, oh, yeah, Monk does this, blah, blah, blah. But in public, he would be very, very actually studious to avoid doing things that were too obviously sort of monkish when he played Monk tunes, trying to get to the deeper level beyond the particular kind of technique. There is, I would say, there is one musician whose piano playing actually technically looks similar to Monk's to me, but he's not a jazz musician. It's Tom Waits, who's a rock musician, but who has a similar kind of flat-fingered technique. And in some ways, I think, has actually modeled certain aspects of his piano playing on Monk's playing. But see, he doesn't have to worry about it because he's not a jazz musician, right? It doesn't have the same danger, I guess.
And then finally, in terms of, you know, the writing a song, composing, did he play all of his, is that all of his material generally? Is that what happened or not? That I don't know.
Yeah, Monk was maybe a little unusual, actually, in terms of jazz musicians from the time. He played primarily his own material, and until recently, he was often the only interpreter of many of his own songs. More of his songs have become more commonly played now since the, I don't know, mid-90s. Excuse me. But certainly back in the 50s and 60s, he was often the only person playing a lot of his sort of more off songs. He also was a great interpreter of pop songs from the 30s and even from the 20s. He tended to play, if he played things that were not his own songs, he played songs that were Tin Pan Alley kind of pop New York songwriting songs from a very limited time, and it's basically from when he was a young man. And he continued to play those throughout his whole life. So, yeah.
How many charts? They call them charts, I guess, right? Is that
right, right, right.
Okay. How many actually did he write in total?
I'm not sure the precise number, but he wrote sort of 60, 65.
Oh, okay.
Not a huge number like someone like Duke Ellington, who wrote hundreds, but still a lot. And maybe most importantly, there are very few duds among them. There's a couple that sort of seemed kind of not to work very well, but almost all of them are real gems.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Sure.
This part of this project, as you as you have explained, is that you're interested in talking with musicians who are working now, particularly musicians mm-hmm. who are playing Monk compositions,
yeah.
and talk with them about what the music means to them and how they approach it, and particularly also dealing with this very difficult, walking this very difficult line between feeling that you owe some faithfulness to him and the music, but you don't want anybody to say, well, you're trying to copy his style. You wouldn't want that to be said of you. So why don't we play the third cut here we have on this CD that you brought in, which is the same tune that we listened to at the beginning.
Yeah.
I Mean You, as played by somebody else, a fellow named Fred Hirsch. And this is a recording from the late 90s. So this is, and apparently this is part of a project where this particular pianist is playing all Monk compositions.
That's right.
Anything in particular you want to say about this before we play?
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is a great recording. It shows really the range of things that Hirsch hears in Monk's music and the range of things that Hirsch brings to it. He's a great musician. He's a Midwesterner. He's from Northern Iowa. He went to college in Northern Iowa at Grinnell College. He's from Cincinnati, and has been a kind of fixture in the Lower East Side of New York for many years. And he does a lot of different things. He's done a Gershwin album, but he's a real kind of aficionado of this music and a great interpreter. He also is a person with a real interest in the classical. Western classical tradition of composition. In when we were talking about this music, he says, you know, he hears this music like any great sort of developmental music, like 19th century, you know, German composition, like the great works of that tradition. And also he hears in it very much the kind of early 20th century modernist stuff. So a composer like Alban Berg or Anton Webern, particularly Webern, he hears in this stuff. And it's a very, very kind of pointillistic, very, very sparse, spare, every note matters kind of thing. So what you'll hear in this, I think, is him bringing that set of ideas, but also the whole history of vernacular American piano playing. So Harlem stride piano playing, which is in there in Monk's music as well, and barrel house blues piano, Ellington's orchestral composition way of thinking about the piano, Monk's synthesis, all of these things. And also I think I hear some avant-garde kind of approaches, some sense of like, saying at moments, we can really move beyond what you would expect, which I guess is also what Monk's doing. So in a sense, he's really cultivating a kind of influence where he brings something to the table and is open to hearing whatever's in that music and trying to really sort of get to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear it.
Thank you.
Right. That is I Mean You, composition by Thelonious Monk, played by Fred Hirsch. That's from Thelonious. Fred Hirsch plays Thelonious Monk. It's a 1998 recording. And I think that's really interesting to me, particularly I hear Fasswaller and George Gershwin. It's like Monk filtered through those two other guys. And again, with some nod to contemporary or at least 20th century classical music. Yeah. There's all kinds of things going on in there. Well, if you say to him, like I'm sure you did say to him, well, Fred, what I can hear the influences of other styles and other performers, but particularly, what do you take from Thelonious Monk that ends up being in your playing? What kind of things would he say?
I'll tell you one of the things that he would say, and that I hear in this, and you may have heard in this as you're listening to it, you may have heard that the tune of that song of I Mean You is always kind of around the edges. It's always kind of there. Even when he's improvising and soloing, he's not completely leaving the original melody behind, but he's working with it. And that's something I think that he talked about and a lot of musicians talked about, was the idea of Monk making whole compositions, whole performances out of a jazz thing. So it's maybe more common for musicians to play the main melody of the thing, and then when they improvise, they're using the basic structure, but the melodies are completely new or completely different, and they're not really. And that's one approach, and it's often really, really great. But it's not what Monk did. And if you listen to almost any recording of Monk improvising, the tune is there the whole time. Either he's playing the tune the whole time, or it's there on the edges. It's there kind of in the background. So that's something that he's doing there that I think he would say. He was picking up on what he's saying there. The way he phrased it to me was that it's about making a unified performance. It is something that Monk was particularly prone to do.
We have about 5 minutes, six minutes. Let's talk with somebody else here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes. When parents come to name their children, they usually have some sense that this will shape their entire future. And I wonder if there's any indication from his family traditions how he would receive a name of Thelonious Sphere.
Right, absolutely. Well, Thelonious, he is not the first Thelonious. His father was also named Thelonious, and his son is Thelonious. So there's that. The sphere thing is nice. The name sphere is actually adopted. He took that name himself in high school. And what kind of person do you have to be, right?
Yeah.
You have to have a sense of yourself, I think, already in high school to say, my middle name is going to be Sphere. that may also actually be a family name, but it's not on his birth certificate, let's say.
Okay. Well, I've always been fascinated, particularly with Sphere.
Yeah, absolutely, right? It's the totality and the thing that is unified and all that.
We all need names like that. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Right on.
Going back to something that an earlier caller raised, and that is his attitude towards the listeners in the sense of, you know, what did he think about what people thought? There is a great tradition, and I suppose it's not just a jazz tradition, a lot of kinds of music, of performers who say, this is my music. If you don't like it, I don't care. If you like it, I don't care.
Right.
This is my music. I'm playing it, and you know, you can take it or leave it. What did he think about what people thought about his music?
Yeah, I think he wanted people to like his music. I think most musicians do, even musicians who say, I don't care. You know, why bother if you're not trying to communicate to somebody? I think he was trying to communicate, but he also was absolutely not going to be stopped from doing what he wanted to do and what he thought was the right thing. And actually, this is the other thing Fred Hirsch told me was most important about Monk. And Hirsch himself is a person who's been iconoclastic and done some things that are very difficult in jazz. He's gay and he came out, and that's very hard to do within the jazz scene, I think. Maybe easier now than it was 10 or 15 years ago. But so that's a real kind of thing. But I think he wanted people to listen to him, and he wanted people to get it, and he wanted people to dig it and not just think it's weird, but really actually get it. But for instance, he continued to play with drummers who set down time and just check-a-doom, check-a-doom. And he continued to play with bass players who really just didn't go outside. They just laid down a really kind of sturdy, thing that he could work with, even when a lot of critics were saying he shouldn't. A lot of critics were saying he should be really embracing avant-garde drummers and avant-garde bass players, and he didn't. And for that matter, he stayed with Charlie Rouse, a tenor sax player who played with him throughout the 60s, for a very long time, even when a lot of critics said Rouse wasn't up to Monk's music. Now, I disagree. I think Rouse was absolutely up to his music, and he's a, kind of a, an ideal foil in some ways. But yeah, so he was more than willing to say, no, I know what this should sound like better than you do, to the critics, yeah, for sure.
There's a lot of things we could do, but I think just to finish, I'd like to play some more music.
Absolutely.
And more of Monk playing Monk. We have one cut here, and I'm not exactly sure how long it is. Everything Happens to Me. This is cut number 6, the last one on the disc. And I thought it might be a good thing for us to play to go out.
Sounds great. This is one of his favorite pop tunes, and it's a humorous kind of text, and one that I think he would have agreed with as a person who had a lot of adversity to face in life. The lyrics go something like, the last stanza of the lyrics: I've telegraphed and called, I've sent airmail special too. Your answer was goodbye, and there was even postage due, which I love, right? He says, I fell in love just once, and then it had to be with you. Everything happens to me.
So all right, very good. Well, we'll play as much as we can. Really sorry to have to fade out of that, but we must, because we're coming here to the end of the time. That's Everything Happens to Me, as performed by Thelonious Monk, and that's from Thelonious Alone in San Francisco, 1959. That's nice, too. That gives us something good to go out on.
Great.
Well, thanks very much. I really appreciate you spending some time with us.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure.
Gabriel Solis, he's assistant professor of music here at University of Illinois, and if you'd like to read his book, it is Monk's Music, Thelonious Monk and Jazz History in the Making. It's published by the University of California Press, and certainly there's plenty of his music that's available for people to listen to. So if you're not familiar with it, you know, go out to the wherever you buy CDs, or go to the library or wherever, and look for his music and do some listening.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Many of our past shows, along with local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
WILL programs are made possible with support from the Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377. Open 7 days a week for lunch and dinner. Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the futures market. We're at mid-session. U.S. soybean futures are sharply higher. They have rallied to a one-week high today. Traders are rebuilding risk premium in prices, as investors are saying that supply issues for global soybeans are a problem. Supply factors are issues once again. And then smaller South American crops are highlighting risks of dryness on newly planted U.S. soybean crops as well. And fresh demand from China today, who picked up 120,000 metric tons of soybeans where the current marketing year is also a supportive feature. Let's go out and check on how futures are trading right up to the moment. We use the composite numbers, that is the pit and electronic trade combined. Here we go. In Kansas City, July wheat, 646 and a half, up 8.5. September, 662, up 8.5. December, 685 and a quarter, up 10.75. July wheat at the board at 625 and a quarter, up 12. September, 639 and three quarters, up 9.25. December, 666, up 9. July corn, 584 and three quarters, up 17 and a quarter, now 17 and a half. September, 528, up 12. December, 5.